Welcome to the Hey Girls Voice podcast. I'm so glad you found your way here. We believe the conversations hosted on this channel are important to the future of the church. Hey Girls Voice is a network of support for survivors of clergy sexual abuse and a nonprofit advocacy group looking to influence the conversation around abuse in religious spaces. We've created this podcast as a platform for women and men to tell their stories. We see survivors as light bringers, courageous voices helping the church be what she was designed to be. The way we honor their courage to raise their voice is by engaging as students, postured to learn from their experiences and insights and their critique. It's our responsibility and our blessing to be shaped by what we hear here. Listening is an act of solidarity. We bear witness. And as we listen, we learn what it means to be allies. And if we let it, we can be shaped into advocates. Together, we rise to stop the abuse and start building a better way. Friends, welcome back to the Hey Girls Voice podcast. It is our pleasure, and that's a literal word, to be here with you as we picture your unseen faces in our mind's eye. You matter. You know, we do this podcast because stories matter and the humans behind stories matter. But just as we're logging in today to hit record on another story, my heart overflows with gratitude and the reality that you matter and your story matters, whether we'll ever hear it or not. You have a reason why you're leaning into this podcast, and that matters. And we honor you, and we are grateful to have you here. And we're looking forward to another conversation. And, you know, even as I say that, that's literal too. I am looking forward to this conversation, but I also recognize that's a little weird because this is a hard and painful story that spans years and multiple forms of abuse. And this is odd work. This is, in some ways, nonsensical work that we do, that we lean into the dark and hard places, and somehow there we find light and truth and intimacy with each other and solidarity and hope. And we can't explain that exactly. I mean, we can, but we can't explain that exactly. And so we are looking forward to this story, but I'm also going to go ahead and give you a trigger warning that we will be covering topics and things related to abuse, not in graphic detail or anything, but this particular story spans a lot of years and a lot of bad behavior. And you may need to take a breather in the midst of it. And that's okay. That's the beauty of this medium. So have your pause button ready. Tune into yourself and honor yourself in the midst of us honoring this story together. So without further ado, I would like to introduce you to Cassandra. And Cassandra, let me just start by saying thank you for bringing your story forward. And I have gotten to spend months, it might be a year even, I don't know. We've spent a good chunk of time together, and this is both a day of high courage, but it was also a day of celebrating of you raising your voice publicly. So welcome and thank you.
Thank you, Ange. It's really nice to be here with you, and it has been quite some time that we've been communicating, so I really appreciate you letting me share my story today. So I'm going to start back in 1994, actually. I graduated from Bible College in Ontario with a Bachelor of Arts in Youth Ministry, and I felt that God was leading me to move out to BC. So God opened the door for me to become a youth pastor at a church in northern BC in the fall of 1994. So I moved out there. I was on my own. I was a single young woman, and I was 21. So I was super happy and excited to be starting ministry and moving into my life purpose, as you can imagine. I went to a church where there was a 46-year-old male senior pastor who I thought would be a mentor to me. He was married and he had three kids. Two of them were in my youth group. And while I was there, the youth group was growing and we saw new young people coming out on Bible study nights. And we could see the Holy Spirit was moving in the group. It was going really well, and things were growing. But then I found out at some point that the senior pastor had taken my picture off of my resume. And this was back in the day when we used to include a photo on our resumes that we would mail in. So I know it's a long time ago. But anyway, I found out that he was carrying my picture around in his wallet and showing people that I was the new youth pastor in town. And then he began to call me late at night and asked me, what are you wearing? Or if I was in bed yet, and other things that were clearly off.
Yeah.
So I could tell things were escalating in a sexual direction, and I gathered my evidence, which included notes and gifts that he was giving me. And I brought it privately to one board member that I thought I could trust. And I told him what was going on with the senior pastor, and I gave him my evidence. So the board called a board meeting, which I attended alone. And I thought the board was going to let me tell them what was going on. Like, this meeting was being called to hear my side of the story, of course. Why wouldn't it be for that purpose? But yeah, exactly. But no, that's not what it was for. I was not permitted to speak at all, and I was actually fired immediately. And I had just moved into my own apartment, and I had to give notice that I needed out because I no longer had a job. So I was in shock. So here I was doing my dream job as a youth pastor, and everyone knew it. And then suddenly I wasn't. I was fired with no investigation, no process, no church farewell, no letter of reference to help me find another job. I was blacklisted in the town, and the principal of the Christian school where I used to work as a substitute teacher said he would make sure I never worked in that town again. I was called a homewrecker by another board member's wife, when in reality it was me that was trying to put a stop to the married pastor's wrong behavior.
No.
And I did hold credentials with my organization at that time. And the senior pastor, he was a presbyter. So he was in the role of a person you would go to if you had a problem with your pastor.
Oh, gosh.
So you see how it...
Yeah.
You know, who's got the power there. So it became evident to me that everyone around were there to defend and support him, but there wasn't anyone around to help me. So I was treated like I was the problem for refusing my senior pastor's advances and speaking up to put a stop to them. The pastor's wife even told me that she forgave me as if I had anything to do with her husband's behavior. It was really hard to find work again, especially with the church's purity culture. And Alexa Barkley's story covers that well, where women are the ones blamed for men's sexual behavior. So to tell a new prospective employer why I had been fired from my last job would make it look like there was something wrong with me. I had to go back to school and get an admin certificate since my degree was now worthless and my ministry was over before it even got started. So for more than 20 years after that, I worked at other jobs and I did ministry inside and outside of my denomination. And during this time, I also ended up working for the district office, and I now work for the national office of the place where I hold my credentials. During that time, I also raised my two sons with my husband, and I had met my husband in that town in 1995. My husband was one of the few people who actually tried to stand up for me and protect me from the church fallout. So that's what happened at the start of my youth ministry. And then I'm going to transition into the other part of the story, which we're covering today. It has to do with when my son joined cadets in 2015. He joined the cadet program where we were living in Ontario. And so I joined the sponsoring committee, which is a parents committee, to help out at the squadron and to find out about the program, since I didn't know anything about it at the time. So at the end of our first year there, the commanding officer invited me to apply to join the officer's side of the organization. So I did. It was a lot of paperwork, and it's part of the Canadian Forces Reserves. So there is a lengthy screening process to go through. The commanding officer who invited me to join got all my paperwork in as he was leaving the position that year. His wife had passed away around that time, and so we lost touch for a while after he left. So in September 2016, a new commanding officer came to the squadron, and I began working for him as the admin officer. I was also the only female member on staff. So this is how I experienced what happened next. Almost immediately, this new commanding officer began to flatter me and direct a lot of inappropriate attention toward me in front of the other male staff and also in private. He was really over the top, excessive. I had to work with him a lot during this time because the admin workload was all consuming. And I put in the extra effort since I figured it was a steep learning curve for me and I wanted to do a good job. When I tried to distance myself from his inappropriate behavior, he would give me the silent treatment, he would exclude me from the staff, or he would make me feel threatened that he would replace me with someone who would be more compliant. So I experienced this grooming cycle of abuse happening, but it was subtle enough that I couldn't put my finger on it, and I didn't recognize it at the time. It was always done so there would be plausible deniability. He would say things to make me question my judgment, like that his wife told him to be careful because women take things the wrong way, as if I was taking things the wrong way. So no matter what I did or said to protect my boundaries, he was always doing or saying something to keep me off balance. And this had been going on for months since I started working with him. There is a massive power differential between us. He was my commanding officer. He was a major with over 12 years experience. He had connections and allies in the chain of command, and he was significantly older than me. Yeah. I was a parent who joined that year to work with cadets, and I had no connections and no knowledge of the organization at that time. So I was sworn in as an officer cadet, and I signed the paperwork on February the 1st, 2017. The night I was sworn in, I was told by another officer, a captain, that I could go to jail now. So I think that was said in jest, but it also sent me the message that I could go to jail now for what I presumed, to mean things like insubordination or not obeying the orders the commanding officer was giving me. And he was giving me plenty of orders, and he was always monopolizing my time, so I had to work with him incessantly. I was also working at my full-time job, and I was exhausted. I kept investing in the cadet program because it was what I wanted to do. I felt like that was God's calling, and it was my passion that I had been robbed of so many years earlier. So the more overt sexual behavior from my commanding officer began happening on February 9th and 15th. Two of the three charges of sexual assault that he would eventually be laid against him. I'm sharing these dates so you can see how close the first two sex assault charges are to the date that I joined the Canadian Forces just 2 weeks before, where I could no longer just leave the cadet program without my commanding officer's approval or authorization, as I understood it at the time. After the February 15th incident, I knew it wasn't an accident and it wasn't me taking things the wrong way. So I talked privately to the captain and I sent an email to the commanding officer to tell him to keep things professional between us and keep his hands off me, basically. I blind copied this captain on the email and I thought he was going to have my back. Things quieted down for a bit after that, but escalated again in mid-March to the beginning of April. It was a really tricky situation to navigate. Loyalty to the commanding officer was a big thing, and he wouldn't take no for an answer, even though I had said no to him in all the polite ways that I could. I was also being isolated from others, and I felt that the CO was keeping me under surveillance. So I wasn't able to go to anyone else safely for help without him finding out about it. He had conditioned me to fear him. The unspoken threat was that I would lose my job, my family, and my future if I told anyone, which felt life-threatening to me. I was being intentionally harmed by the person in authority over me who I was dependent on if I wanted to be able to continue doing the work that was meaningful to me. And he knew how important this was to me, so he was able to use it to leverage it for his advantage. This created a profound sense of confusion that made my brain feel like it was being turned into scrambled eggs. No matter what I did, there was no possible way to resolve the double bind. This is intrinsic to abuse, and it's very damaging to the psyche. My soul was disintegrating as my integrity was being torn apart. I had to behave a certain way around him to be safe and to stay on his good side, which was in absolute conflict with who I am as a person. I became unable to access my logical brain around him, so my survival responses kicked in. This fawn response was a coping mechanism. I understood later that what I did was my body and mind's sophisticated response to earn the trust of my captor while looking for a way to escape without tipping him off.
Yeah.
I began to deteriorate at my full-time civilian job and in my life from the stress of this abusive situation. I was really trapped, and I couldn't get out of this without help. I was also afraid to tell my husband because I thought he would tell me to just quit cadets, and I didn't want to do that. I was really committed to making it work because I didn't want to lose this chance to work with youth again. The last week of April in 2017, I woke up one morning with the verse, "The Lord will fight for you." It was so strongly on my heart, and I felt this was the confirmation for me to get out now. God had provided a way out. With the original commanding officer, the one who had helped me join, he came back into contact with me at that time. And he was able to advise me of my rights and help me report my current commanding officer's conduct to the chain of command the last week of April. So I knew from my previous experience that if you report sexual misconduct, you will be fired. I fully expected that my time at cadets was done for good. I was directed to contact the Sexual Misconduct Resource Center, which is there to help Canadian Force members, where I was actually able to talk to the military police anonymously about my situation. And I thought that was really great because I actually spoke to them over the phone for several days. And then they asked me if I wanted to go ahead with an investigation. So I said yes. I was shocked when the chain of command removed this commanding officer instead of me once they were notified that a military police investigation was taking place.
Yeah.
So you would think this would be the end of the problem, but it was not. I gave the police the name of the captain who I thought would be a witness for me, since he had observed it for himself and I had told him more than one instance of inappropriate behavior. I had also told this captain about being fired from my job in 1995 when I was talking to him about what this current commanding officer was doing because I didn't want to lose my job again. I had worked at being extremely careful for years to protect myself and present myself professionally because of what had happened in my first youth pastor job. I never wanted anyone to be able to blame me again for something I didn't do, especially when I was the one who was working to preserve my own integrity. And I should have never been put in either of those situations in the first place.
Right.
Yeah. Well, it turns out that this captain told the police during their first investigation that basically everyone was afraid of me making up allegations against them. So the police only interviewed this one captain, and I had given the police his name as a witness because he knew what happened, right? And otherwise, like, why would I give his name to the police if I thought he was going to say these harmful things about me? Doesn't make sense. Then the police told me in my victim debrief that they didn't want to interview any other witnesses because they didn't want to harm my commanding officer's reputation.
Oh,
yeah. The implication was that I must be lying. but it wasn't me who was lying to them.
Right.
Yeah, I found out later that the accused commanding officer had set it up to look like I had a conduct problem to the detachment above us. When I was able to get in contact again with, there's a couple of commanding officers involved here. So one is the one who was charged and one is the one who was helping me. So the one who was helping me, he was trying to work with me to set up a transfer to another unit so I could get away from the commanding officer who was in charge of me. The good commanding officer told me not to meet with my commanding officer alone and that I could take another officer with me to ask him to sign the transfer paper. So at my squadron, there was a deputy commanding officer. I'll refer to him as the DCO. And he was in relationship with the good CO commanding officer. So I asked the DCO if he could go with me to get the transfer document signed. And I told the DCO what was going on. So he conferred with the good CO and was concerned because he had to report this to our commanding officer's friend at detachment. So, yeah, we all know where this is going. But the other commanding officer, the one that was helping me, he also reported to the detachment commander so that my CO's friend at detachment wouldn't be able to sweep it under the rug. That tells you what lengths this guy went to prevent me from being able to get away from him or report what was going on and to ensure that I would not be believed if I did come forward. So this was such a betrayal by everyone. The commanding officer who assaulted me, the captain who I thought would be a truthful witness, and then the police. They closed the case in May 2018, and it was such a long time to wait. It was 13 months.
Oh.
And I was supposed to trust the process, which was really a sham. So I was diagnosed with PTSD in April 2018 from the trauma of the assaults and the trauma of reporting them. Right. I had to take a leave of absence from my civilian job in 2017 after going through the first police interview. I couldn't function at all. I couldn't take care of myself or my family. I couldn't cope with anything. I suffered such a profound sense of loss, disorientation, grief, and confusion about everything that I had been through. I couldn't make sense of what had happened to me. And keep in mind, I reported this before Me Too, when there wasn't even language for what I was facing. Somehow I kept moving forward, slowly, one step at a time, and I didn't want to have to quit cadets just because of this horrific experience. Once the case was closed, the pervasive sense of injustice and betrayal made the Canadian Forces uniform and going to cadets very triggering for my nervous system, but I kept doing it anyway. I would need large amounts of time to recover my energy before and after cadet events. But when I was at cadets, I was energized by the work I was doing, and I had a decent team of adults to work with after the commanding officer was removed and the captain had left to go to another unit. In the fall of 2018, the commanding officer who had been removed reach mandatory retirement age in the Canadian Forces. And my chain of command told me that he would not be returning to the organization and I should move on. So I did. I felt safer that I could continue in the cadet program if he wasn't going to be there and I wouldn't end up running into him somewhere. Well, I was wrong again. So I found out in January 2021 that his former squadron hired him back as a civilian instructor, which is a paid position on staff. I was terrified of him and terrified that he was back in a position of influence within the organization where I felt he could harm me again. The fear and the feeling that I could not escape from him still lived in my body. I asked for some options from the Sexual Misconduct Resource Center in February 2021. And they said I could call the military police and ask them questions about the first investigation. So I did. I spoke to the victim services coordinator who had handled my case back in 2017, and I said that I had some questions for the warrant officer. Victim services asked me, "When do you want them to call you back?" And I said, "Tomorrow at 1 o'clock." The next day, it wasn't the warrant officer who called me back. It was the captain in charge of the military police in Borden. And he said that he and the warrant officer had reviewed my case and found several instances of sexual assault that were not investigated properly. Right. So they were reopening the case and assigning new investigators. I never expected this was even possible, and I didn't even ask for it. My son reminded me that God reopened the case when I had no faith. This time, the police interviewed 6 witnesses, plus the captain again, and laid 3 counts of sexual assault in July 2021. That year, the news began reporting regularly on the sexual misconduct issues in the Canadian Forces, and Justice Fish had just tabled his report in Parliament on June 1st. And so because of that, the police gave me the option of having the charges laid in the military system or the civilian system. So I chose the civilian system for many reasons, including that this commanding officer was already retired from the Canadian Forces. So there wasn't really anything the Canadian Forces could do, even if he was convicted. Like, there's no real consequences. But having the charges laid was such a weight lifted off of me to finally feel believed and to have enough evidence for the police to lay charges even 4 years later. Yeah. The military police process is to have the prosecutor review the evidence to decide if they have a reasonable prospect of conviction before they lay the charges. So in my understanding in the civilian system is the police lay the charges first, and then a prosecutor has to review the file and determine if there's enough evidence to proceed in court. So the charges in my case had merit when they were laid. The long periods of waiting and silence during the 2 police investigations I had to go through, and then during the long court process, are excruciating. The guy who was charged has all of the advantages and protection of the law, and it seems that I do not. I was constantly on guard and feeling like I had to defend myself. In order for the accused to be innocent until proven guilty, it effectively means that the person who reports abuse must be lying. So the justice system tells us to report sex assault, and then it treats us like we're the enemy and leaves us hanging while it defends and protects our abusers.
Yeah. Okay. Dude. Okay. So I have questions. We have questions. The listeners don't get the opportunity to ask you questions. But before any of that, before we take a short break, because we deserve it.
Yes.
Let me just say, I'm sorry for what you've been through.
Thanks.
Really sorry that multiple industries let you down in both training their people in appropriate behavior and then training their people to respond appropriately to cries for help and justice. And I'm sorry for the price that you paid has been heavy. And your badassery shows all over the place.
Thank you.
It does. But this is not the way that warriors should be made.
No.
I'm sorry. And I just want to pause and honor your story and your courage for sharing it with us.
Thanks, Ange.
Okay, let's take a little pause. We'll do a little commercial break, but maybe you want to do a little pause and do like a bio break or something. We're going to lean into conversation. And around like application of this, there's a little bit more of a story to unfold, but also I want to talk about coping mechanisms and all kinds of stuff as you weathered a story that spans such a long period of time and kept getting up and getting up and getting up and making the phone calls. So let's take a little pause and then you come back when you're ready to have a chat. to listen in on our chat. We'll see you on the other side of this little break.
Are you a caregiver looking for resources to help children understand body safety? Check out Pendle's Power, a children's book that teaches age-appropriate concepts about consent, body safety, and the power of their voice. Written in English and Kiswahili, children will not only learn a new language, but also learn how to harness the power of their voice to speak up against sexual abuse. To get a copy, visit www.pendlespower.com.
Too often, survivors of clergy sexual abuse are exiled from telling of their own stories. This must stop. Story Rising is a multiple-day, on-site intensive where survivors have space and resources to reclaim, curate, and share their stories, raising their voices to be heard above the noise. Survivors gather with peers and trained coaches from Hagar's Voice in a trauma-informed space rooted in the beauty of creation. Participants emerge empowered to fully embrace again the main role in their own story. They are strengthened, encouraged, and equipped to heal as their story rises. To learn more, visit hagarsvoice.com/story rising.
Okay, we're back. All right, so an obvious question to me right off the bat is, what were your responses in these two different contexts? Because you experienced a similar type of abuse, but they're in different contexts, and you were a different age without, you know. So can you just juxtapose your internal response in these different contexts?
Perhaps? Yeah, I would love to, actually. So the religious context, which happened when I was in my 20s, at that time, church and God were both tied together for me. So when that happened, and the church didn't do what they were supposed to do, it shattered my faith in God. And I felt like God didn't show up for me to defend me. And instead, I was punished for doing what I thought was right. Of course, that was a huge soul wound. After that, I worked very hard to be a good worker, since it seemed like my only value came from my performance. Like I only mattered if I was doing something worthwhile that other people valued. I learned to read the room as a survival mechanism to protect myself from any sexual attention. I was careful how I dressed and interacted with people. But even in Bible college, people said I was someone who didn't flirt. So even before my first ministry position, I wasn't careless with my behavior or my dress. I tried to follow the purity culture rules that I grew up in, which puts the onus and the blame on women for men's behavior toward them. But after losing my job in BC, I felt like the Bible applied to everyone else except me. So even if I prayed, God didn't care about me. I felt like I couldn't let myself be free to love anything or anyone again, since I had learned that God would take away anything I put my heart into. So that was really hard. I also found it hard to go to church on and off over the years. For a while, I used to cry whenever I was in church, and so it was better for me not to go if I couldn't keep my composure there. The betrayal of God and the church made me wish that I had never been born, because I didn't even want to go to heaven when I died. I just wanted to have never existed. But in the Canadian Forces context, they actually had a better response in some ways than the church did. They did do some things right. So they removed the commanding officer, and they apologized to me that I had had this negative experience so early on in my career. And others who work with me have my back, and they have set me up for success. And I didn't feel ashamed in the Canadian Forces in the same way that I was by the church. And after I contacted the chain of command in 2021, I was given an assisting officer, which I should have had in 2017, but no one really talked to me during that first investigation, because they can't become a witness to the case. So it's almost like you're not even allowed to talk to anybody when you really need support. And there was something else that happened in 2020. So before that, I even knew the case would be reopened. God had brought a couple of providential relationships into my life. And one of them was a retired lieutenant colonel. And he was able to advise me on Canadian Forces policy. And he was a really big support listening to me when I needed someone to talk to. So, yeah, that made a big difference.
Some differences there. Yeah. I talked to a lot of survivors who are in the court process or are considering the court process from various angles. Some have like theological hangups with the court process. Some have just literal ignorance. Like there's whatever. So I'm just curious, could you talk to us a little bit about what the court process was like?
Sure, I will. It was really long and there was large gaps of time in between the court dates. I would say the most harmful part in all of that was dealing with the police and how they treated me in their first investigation, because they didn't handle my case in a timely manner and they didn't investigate it properly, which actually created other problems for me in the long run. So it created multiple police statements and my counseling records, which would later end up being subpoenaed to be used against me in court. And I didn't know that your first police statement is the statement that is used in court and that everything else you say is compared against. So I reported to the police so soon after the assaults that I was still too broken to make sense of it at the time. So we now know that this is common with abuse survivors who have been traumatized. But I ended up giving three police interviews, May and November 2017, and then again in March 2021. So while all of my statements outline the chain of events, my understanding of what happened changed as I was able to process the trauma over time. During my first police statement, I was still minimizing the abuse and trying to accept responsibility for things I had no control over. It took a long time for me to realize the malevolence that I was up against and piece together what had happened. I know now that the person who had all the power and authority was the one who carried the responsibility and control over the situation, and that was not me. In 2017, I trusted the police to be the experts and understand the seriousness of what I was reporting to them. I had no help in giving my statement, no support, and no understanding of what I was doing. In fact, my first police statement was given in the basement of the Peel Police Station in a metal chair that was chained to the floor. So that's how that felt. Anyway, if you do report a sexual assault to the police, you should know that everything you say will be used against you in court. You will be the one on trial. The accused is advised to get a lawyer and they don't have to give any statements to the police. But you, as the complainant, are given no help and no counsel. So in your openness to tell the truth, you will say things that will be used against you in court. In fact, everything can be twisted in a way that you would never expect. One example that I heard, not from my case, is that if you're reporting a sex assault and you say something like, "So I was on my way home from my AA meeting and such happened," the response would be, "Oh, so you're an alcoholic."
Yeah.
Like as if that has anything to do with the assault. But the defense will muddy the water with things about you and your character that have nothing to do with what actually happened to you. Another thing I would say about the court process is that I think there is a system of checks and balances in place, but victims don't know what their rights are and they don't know how to enforce them. Where abusers do know their rights and they do know how to play the system to their advantage. And I think some people in positions of power have been able to get away with abusing their subordinates, in part because good Christian girls like me were taught to turn the other cheek instead of rebuking an elder in the presence of all so that others may take warning. 1 Timothy 5:20. One of the verses that God gave me this year was Jeremiah 1:17-19. It says, "Get up and prepare for action. Go out and tell them everything I tell you to say. Do not be afraid of them, or I will make you look foolish in front of them. For see, today I have made you strong, like a fortified city that cannot be captured, like an iron pillar or a bronze wall. You will stand against the whole land, the kings, officials, priests, and the people of Judah. They will fight you, but they will fail. For I am with you, and I will take care of you. I, the Lord, have spoken. In the Bible, bronze symbolizes God's righteous judgment. Bronze is forged in fire, and so am I. If you report an abuser, get ready for the fight of your life, and the enemy fights dirty. You must learn to trust how the Holy Spirit is speaking to you and write down the promise verses he gives you. The devil used scripture against Jesus in the wilderness, so you need to know how to rightly apply the word of God to your life and hold on to it even when conflicting scriptures are brought up that go against what God has specifically told you. This creates fear and doubt in your mind, and you need to stop it by reminding yourself, what did God say to me? And repeat it until you silence those false voices. You have to fight for yourself. I thought of God as someone who was out there who would magically fix the situation and bring justice, but that's not how it works. One of my pastoral friends said she had a vision of me standing as a little girl in a vast field all by myself, but my armor was too big for me. My inner little girl had to grow herself up, and one day, last fall, I woke up and I realized that my armor is fitting properly now. It is up to me to draw upon the Holy Spirit who lives within me to fight the battles ahead. I have to do it, and I need the right people around me to help me fight this battle. And God has been bringing those people into my life. I have also had to take many risks in faith, not knowing what the outcome would be.
It's a powerful visual. I just love that sentence. One day I woke up and it fits. Given all that you experienced, which I would think is some form of trauma in that court system, what were you hoping? Like when you had to know that was going to be hard, like there's no part of us that actually wants to go through that process on our way to justice. But what is it that you were hoping to accomplish through the court system that had you engage with it?
Well, I actually didn't realize how hard it would be. And I didn't know not to trust the system at the beginning. But
that makes sense.
Yeah. So I didn't specifically have an accomplishment goal. Things just kind of snowballed into, like, I was directed who to talk to, and then they opened the investigation and then things like that. But once I did report it to the police, the process took on a life of its own, and I didn't really have any control over it. There are tons of obstacles along the way to even getting to setting a trial date, which mine was set for February 2024. So it took a long time to get there.
Right. Okay, so listener, we're tracking along years of various parts of this story. But here in the court system, in this part of the story, like, I want to, Cassandra's been kind enough to let me ask anything. And I talked to so many survivors about this court system process that I think it's worthy to hear a little bit more detail about the kind of back and forth. So you've already spoken about, you know, how long it was and how it stacked against you and all of that. And I know there's got to be some of us in this audience, like I would say myself included, who is like, make it stop.
Yeah, for sure.
So if you're like, we're going to lean back into to more of this story, but if you're finding yourself with this, like, I got to get out of here, I want to note that. I don't, like, you maybe really do need a break and you can take a break. And actually, like, don't violate yourself on the process of hearing a story. You can stand in solidarity after a pause and on a different day to come back and honor this story. What I want to say, though, is like the part of me that is currently like, I don't want to ask another question because I don't want to hear the answer to this question is this is us entering into the suffering of survivors. Like, I don't even want to hear the shortened version of the story. It's so painful. I want to turn away in self-preservation. And I hope that I can give myself enough empathy and that you can give yourself enough compassion and empathy and also let this be a moment. So, like, we can pause and we can come back to it. That is our privilege. Isn't that beautiful? But also, like, as you honor those feelings, this is your solidarity with survivors. Like, we are having to find wells of resilience to stay engaged with the story. Deep reservoirs of resilience to live through this story is a whole other thing. So you don't need to keep listening to this story out of guilt in no way, shape, or form. What does that serve anybody? That's not an honor. Like, no, no. So if you find yourself truly struggling to stay engaged and wanting to turn away from the pain of this story, honor those feelings. Sit with those feelings. That is okay. Push pause until you can come back with well of resilience to hear the rest of the stand in solidarity. But this is just me earmarking, even for myself, the reality that I find my internals being like, make it stop, which is a fraction of survivors feel, make it stop.
Yeah.
So if you need to stop, do that. Pause it. We'll still be here on another day. Okay, Samantha, please tell us how, the story of going through court, like there was a lot of back and forth and a lot of things. So can you that?
I certainly can. So I'm going to just tell you off the start that along the way, God did give me specific promises for the whole court process at different times. And I believe those were his words to me for the circumstances as they came along. During the lengthy court process, the accused was offered a plea deal. The first one was December 2021. It's a Section 810 peace bond and counseling, which means he wouldn't have a criminal record. So it's my understanding that this is the plea deal that most defense counsel would want to get for their client in a sex assault case. Pretty sweet deal. So yeah. So the Crown told me that the accused would agree to a peace bond, but he would not agree to counseling. So the Crown met with me after that, and she said, "This is going to trial, and we will be expending the resources to prosecute this case." Mm-hmm. The Crown told me that the defense would be going after my counseling records, and that it would be a 2-week jury trial, and that she told me that the Crown would be asking for 4 to 6 months in jail and 20 years on the sex offender registry if he was convicted. So the jury trial felt like it was being presented as a threat to me from the defense. I sensed that it was like meant for maximum humiliation for me, since I would be the one on the stand and the accused doesn't have to testify at all. And the application for my counseling records was also presented as a threat, and it was clearly being used as a witness intimidation tool. So the threat was, drop out or we will decimate you publicly. So then, between May and August last year, the defense and the Crown were negotiating another plea deal to let him plead guilty to one count of assault and to admit to all the facts in my statement. In exchange, the Crown would ask for 3 to 4 months in jail, 10 years weapons ban, and 10 years on the sex offender registry. And during this plea deal time, the Crown gave me some information on what he was willing to admit to in his statement of facts. And that gave me some comfort that he had acknowledged some of his wrongdoing. But because this was done through his lawyer, it doesn't count as an admission of guilt in court. And if he did plead guilty to an assault charge instead of sexual assault, it would limit what I could say in my victim impact statement. So you can only say the impact of what the accused is convicted of, not the whole impact of what they actually did to you. So that, plus his statement of alternate facts, was a firm no from me. Yeah. He would also not agree that it was repeated conduct over time, which is supported by 3 counts of sexual assault that he was charged with. So I said no to this plea deal. I also felt like the accused was not negotiating in good faith and that he was trying to delay the resolution and drag it out as long as possible so I would get worn down and drop out. Yeah. Then in September last year, the Crown elected to proceed to trial by indictment in the Superior Court of Justice, and the accused had to elect how he wanted to be tried. But instead of making his election, the agent for the defense said that they had sent the Crown an amended statement of facts and resolution conditions. But this time in court, the judge put her foot down and ordered the defense counsel to come back to court that afternoon and elect judge or judge and jury trial. Well, I think this is funny actually, but the agent for the defense returned in the afternoon and she said she couldn't reach the defense counsel. So the judge adjourned the case until the following Monday at 10 a.m. and she required the accused to make his election that day. So I'm glad the judge stopped with the back and forth like nonsense. Anyway, then 6 months later, so now we're into March of this year, the dates were finally set for a February 2024 for a jury trial. The Crown met with me in March, and she told me that the defense was applying to subpoena my counseling records under Section 278 of the Criminal Code, and the hearing for that was scheduled for September the 12th. And I was provided with a lawyer to represent me for this application. So the lawyer is allowed to represent me to limit the amount of information that the judge may or may not decide is allowed into court. So this is a provision in the law. It's supposed to protect the victim from having their private and confidential records brought into court. But if it really did exist to protect us, then why did the defense begin threatening to go after my counseling records as far back as January last year? So the Section 278 provision is actually being used as a bullying and witness intimidation tool by the defense. And because of that, I registered a complaint with the Federal Ombudsman for Victims of Crime in June. And you've got my letter there, so it's going to be posted as part of this podcast. Then in July, we received this expansive Section 278 application from the defense to obtain my private counseling records spanning from 2017 to the present, meaning that they would be allowed to receive my ongoing counseling records. Like as if everything I say to my counselor from now on, like they might as well just sit in the room with me. Yeah. So it effectively cuts off my safe access to counseling until the trial ends.
Right.
And the Section 278 application is based on rape myths and harmful stereotypes, which is not permitted under Canadian law, but a judge signed off on it anyway. And the law prevents anyone from sharing its contents, so it cannot be scrutinized by those who should be overseeing the courts. It's also used to bias the trial judge against the victim, because even if the contents are not allowed at trial, the misleading information in the application is used to make the victim look bad, and the victim is not allowed to defend themselves against it. So that the application, and because I know that the accused is abusive and manipulative,
right.
I knew it would be more dangerous for me if he had access to more of my personal life and information. Matthew 7:6 says, "Do not give dogs what is sacred. Do not throw your pearls to pigs. If you do, they may trample them under their feet and turn and tear you to pieces." This is the evil that the defense does with your sacred counseling records. that were created in a trusting relationship that had to be built over time. And the threat of being harmed by someone like that doesn't end when the court is over. It is absurd that the law allows people who abuse others to get more access to their victims' intimate thoughts, feelings, vulnerabilities, and fears in order to harm them further. And especially in light of victims who are murdered by their intimate partners in domestic assault cases, this is exceedingly dangerous.
Yeah.
So when I was dealing with this decision, I felt like God was giving me a choice this time. So there was no process and no choice before, but now there has been a process with significant evidence to have the charges laid and to proceed through court long enough to have the trial date set. So I know there was a reasonable prospect of conviction and I know the truth of what happened. So I felt like God was saying, if you want to go through court, I will be with you. And if you want to end it now, I will be with you. And so I prayed a fleece prayer that if the Crown would be open to staying the charges and put my reasons on the record in court, I would move in that direction. Well, the same day as I prayed that prayer and the question was sent to the Crown, the answer came back from the Crown that she would be open to that option. And Crowns are not usually that accessible, especially in the busiest court in all of Canada. So I took that as confirmation and it sat right in my spirit. So on the last court date, which was September the 1st, those who I had asked to attend online were there with me. It felt very satisfying to have such meaningful support present for me. A CBC News reporter also observed the proceedings and wrote an article about it. And the article let people know that the defense counsel is allowed to apply for all your counseling records to use them against you in court.
You've been kind enough to give us access. You've had multiple articles written and the show notes are amazing for this episode, listener. So whether you're a survivor thinking about going to court or want to see an example of a formal complaint that was written, it's amazing. It's amazing. So make sure to check out the show notes. You've been very generous with us. Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, so this court process seems deeply unsatisfying to me. And this is not commercial to be anti-court, people. This is one story. So what we do here on this podcast is just raise up the voices of survivors to tell their story and their experiences. So this is not meant to be a prescriptive episode. This is just Cassandra sharing their story with the court process. And this is just one human, Angela, say that seems deeply unsatisfying. So were you able to find any like supplemental justices? Because it just seems like a lot of the stories I hear about the justice system are not very justice-y. So were you able to find any supplemental justices?
Yeah, it's not very justice-y, but I am going to tell you a little bit more. So you know, when someone does harm you through sexual abuse, they do take so much away from you. It severely affects your sense of safety, your sense of self, your identity, your autonomy, and it harms your ability to connect with others. And so after my faith had been shattered in my early 20s, this 2017 experience ripped me completely apart. The shattered pieces I had tried to put back together during the past 22 years were utterly decimated. And I will never be that person again. So through all this long court process, it was 7 years to the day since I started with the cadet unit staff. God was restoring what was destroyed bit by bit over time. Like the clay in the potter's hands, I was being torn down and destroyed and then built up and planted again. Jeremiah 18. It's still taking time, but along the way, God has been restoring my faith in him. God restored my identity. He has restored my place in society. He's given me a place of honor instead of shame. And I've come back into myself so I can be fully human and feel my feelings and use my voice to speak up. God also went back into my past, and this year I received confirmation that the senior pastor in BC had confessed to his inappropriate behavior, apparently back in 1995, but no one ever told me or came alongside me at the time to help me get back on my feet. But my current boss sees my journey through that experience as directing me to the significant role I play at the national office now. And last year, the Canadian Forces did a unit disciplinary investigation on the captain who I'd gone to for help and determined that he had not fulfilled his duty to report in 2017. He could have helped prevent all of this, but at least I have been heard now. Another part of the supplemental justice is with that first CBC article that came out in December last year, it was such a huge source of justice for me. It was a miracle how that even came about, and I know God orchestrated that for me. It let people know what really happened, why this commanding officer had been removed, since it was all kept under wraps this whole time. One of the biggest reasons people report sex assault is to protect others. And I don't believe this man woke up one morning in his mid-60s and knew how to manipulate me so skillfully without having practiced before. So it was really important to me that his charges were made public so others would know he had finally been caught. If there are other victims, I hope they will be able to come forward now.
Right. Okay. So there's some things in there. There's some things, some miracles in there.
Yeah.
You know, we've talked about resilience, even just from a listener's standpoint, the resilience to sit through even listening to this story. I get, because I've traveled with you, I get to know some of this stuff, but I would really love our listeners to hear some of the ways that you have gotten back up again and again. You don't just bootstrap it. You don't develop this kind of resilience through self-violation. That is not the path, but it is the tempting one when you're in it of like give up or bootstrap. So would you just share a little bit of what you have learned and experienced and done to get back up again this many times?
Yes. Thanks, Ange. My son observed me getting broken down so many times throughout this process. He was the one who was a cadet when I joined. Yeah. And there is a lot of fear and grief in the tearing apart and then having to get back up again. It really drains your energy and it interferes with every part of your life. My husband compared it to being in the boxing ring and taking so many hits, but I kept getting back up to stand to fight another day. I used to care a lot about what others thought of me, and I lived to please people, which is a fond response to trauma. But now I care more about how I feel about others. So instead of thinking, do you like me? I think, do I like you? And I make decisions based on what I feel the Lord is leading me to do. John 15:16 says, you did not choose me, but I chose you. And I appointed you to go and bear fruit, fruit that will remain, so that whatever you ask the Father in my name, he will give you. Talking to others who had been through the court process helped me because they understood how horrific it is. It is definitely oppressive. It is a huge spiritual battle when you speak up and bring light to the darkness.
Yeah.
There are a lot of people and entrenched systems that don't want to be exposed, and they don't want the system that currently benefits them to change. So in terms of trauma healing, for me, it was experienced in the presence of an empathetic witness like you, by the safe people who matter to me, who knew my story and cared about me anyway. I also found the responsive, righteous anger of these safe people helpful to know that there are people in positions of authority who have the moral compass to know the difference between right and wrong and who were willing to take action to help me. So because my police statements were seen by my chain of command after the case was closed in 2018, and because I still continued to work at cadets in spite of that, I felt like everyone knew what had happened And it left me feeling like there was some question in their mind as to my character and integrity. So when the case was reopened in 2021, I decided to live my shame out loud, and I started to fight back and speak up to defend myself. I had had to stay silent the first time so that it didn't interfere with the police investigation. But this time I knew that staying silent hadn't helped me at all. And so I decided to speak out. The second police investigation gave me a chance to question and bring attention to all the barriers that I had run into with the police and with the Canadian Forces response to me after my first report. I found my voice, and I feel that I have earned the respect of those in authority over me. It took a long time, but the trust, empathy, and support of those who know me and know the facts of the situation have restored me. I feel that I am supported and valued for who I am. And through the process, those in authority over me have also earned my respect. One of the promise verses God gave me in 2017 and then again in 2023 was Ruth 3:11. "And now, my daughter, don't be afraid. I will do for you all you ask. All the people of my town know that you are a woman of noble character."
Knowing you, I can see why that verse spoke so dearly to you. I mean, you've referenced it even in this story, in this context, how much your character and integrity work. So to have an anchor verse like this, mm-hmm. I can see what matters to you. Okay. So chronologically, we left this story off September 1st with yes. last court date, but we yeah. left our audience hanging on tenterhooks. Can you wrap the story up with like September 1st and beyond? Like, don't leave them hanging.
All right. So September the 1st, I made the choice. And the Crown did stay the charges at my request. She put my reasons on the record, which are the expansive application for my counseling records. And I didn't think that he should access those. So I was done with that. Now, as soon as the case ended, the defense counsel, they could see that that CBC reporter was online because his name was in all caps. Like, we all had to sit there for an hour and 45 minutes waiting for the matter to come up. So it's not like it was missed anyway. But anyway, the defense counsel made the suggestion to the court. This is what she said. "To the extent that there's any media here, perhaps I'll just put on the record, I believe there's a 486.4 publication ban, which would extend past the end of these proceedings." So let's note the source is coming from the defense here, which like doesn't protect their client. Say again.
That publication ban is actually supposed, again, their yeah. weapon thing yeah. is meant to protect.
Exactly. So anyway, the judge, like, she did check and said that the indictment didn't indicate that there was any publication ban, but she ordered the presumed publication ban to continue. So, like, we all know it was a lie, what the defense had said, but they did end up deceiving the judge into putting the publication ban back on my name, even though I'd already had it removed by the court in 2021. Oh. So I didn't find out about this till the next week, and I was irate. So the Crown had to file an application to have it removed again. And because it was done after the case concluded, the process is more complicated than having it removed while the case is still going on. So then on September the 11th, the Crown filed an ex parte application. So the publication ban should have been lifted without the defense even being notified of it. Yeah. Then, so I'm waiting because there's like, you're just sitting there waiting longer than it should have been. But anyway, this other thing was happening in Parliament. So there's this woman, she's with My Voice, My Choice. Her name is Morelle Andrews. She was presenting before the Standing Committee on Justice and Human Rights on October the 5th. Yeah. and they were reviewing Bill S-12 regarding publication bans. So she just happened to include what happened to Cassandra with the defense reintroducing a publication ban on my name after it had already been removed. Mm-hmm. The next week, I received information that the judge had directed the Crown to serve the defense to see if they had a position on whether the publication ban should be lifted or not, even though the application had been filed, so the defense would not be notified and should not have any say in the matter. So I was very angry about this. Anyway, the next day, I received the court order that the publication ban was removed and the judge had noted the error. But the next week, so October 17th, Dr. Benjamin Roebuck, the federal ombudsman for victims of crime, who I had been in contact with and who I filed the complaint with. So he was presenting now at the Justice and Human Rights Committee. So he included in his statements the need for victims to have unconditional safety when talking about their own violations to their bodies in counseling. So Dr. Roebuck and the executive director from their office personally attended my September 1st court date, and they were able to observe how routine it was for defense counsel to apply for victims' counseling records and even children's aid records. So their office later confirmed with the CBC reporter that they plan to launch a systemic review of how victims of sexual assault are treated in the justice system, including a look at the 278 issue. I had also told Dr. Roebuck that I wish someone had told me to speak to a lawyer before I reported to the police, because I had mentioned my counselor to them. Yeah. And in my counseling records, it would have revealed that I began journaling as part of my lengthy healing process. When the defense subpoenaed this, it was too much of a privacy violation for me, which led to my request to have the charges stayed. So I would give advice to anyone, if you're thinking of reporting something to the police, there is 4 hours of free independent legal advice available in Ontario and some of the other provinces. The link to that is also in your show notes. So do that before you speak to the police would be my recommendation. So that's, I feel like the defense tried to throw a muzzle on me on the way out of court, and it ended up putting my matter in front of the Justice and Human Rights Committee. So I believe that God has more to come out of this, and we're going to make some changes to the laws and how we're treated.
I just got to say, I mean, there's a lot of things to say, but we'll wrap this up. I just got to say how proud I am of you. That you went into court. I mean, it kind of feels like you just got sucked into court. And I know the Canadian, I understand the US court system better than the Canadian one, but it does have this like, oh, it sort of gets taken out of your hands and off it goes. But, you know, as you engaged with the court system, your agency was used to participate and to push for justice.
Yeah.
Then as you saw how it was taking a toll on you, or saw how it was going, or saw how it's really remarkable to me that you switched and used your agency to actually pull out without self-violation, without tucking your tail. You used your agency to say, these are my terms. And I don't even, again, this is not listener, this is not prescriptive, but knowing the story and watching Cassandra go through this, that is really remarkable to change your definition of justice, to change your definition of success, and to move as your discernment process sees fit is like really commendable. So thank you for the honesty and openness of raising your voice here. Thank you for the number of ways in your story you have spoken words to things that survivor after survivor after survivor has questioned within themselves, even without having words around it. I know that the various ways that you've talked about, both how you've processed, how you have looked back and reviewed and critiqued your own engagement in your own story, the ways that you have found wisdom to stand back up after obstacle after obstacle after obstacle, you have been a gift to us today. Thank you for this huge deposit into our learning, into our own self-care, into our insights, and into our empathy. I just thank you so much.
Thank you, Ann.
Friends, thank you for using your time to honor survivors. It is incredibly encouraging to survivors and their advocates to see how many of you are leaning in. Please consider subscribing so you can bear witness to each story as it arrives on this channel. Sharing an episode is an act of solidarity. We would love for you to raise their voice on your own feeds. We honor you in your quest to abuse-proof yourself, grow your skills as an ally, and lean in with courage to live as an advocate. If we can help you in this in any way, please reach out to us at contact@hagarsvoice.com. Whether you're a survivor of clergy sexual abuse or a decision maker in a religious context, you're not alone. Special thanks to Jake Welch, our podcast producer and ally. We unabashedly invite you to consider supporting Hagar's Voice financially. Funds are used to provide things like assistance to survivors to resources they need, technology that supports things like this podcast and allows us to safely connect to and advocate for survivors, making Hagar's Voice more broadly known to survivors, and raising our collective voice to educate and inspire change. Together we rise to stop the abuse and start building a better way. So keep leaning in and join us.